Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. We'll just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl. Just you and me. Wake up, all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long. Judgment day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up, all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
Right, let's change the world. We'd like to welcome you back to Missing Pages of History. We have had a little extended hiatus, and we'd like to wish everybody a happy new year 2019, and we'd like to thank you for staying with us. This is our first program of this new year, and it's the beginning of African History Month, and we hope that this program we have today would do justice to this important time period as we continue to celebrate and learn our history. Like always, Missing Pages of History is an organization dedicated to the upliftment of our underserved communities. We'd like to welcome everyone again to MPH, and today's theme on Saturday, February the 2nd, 2019, is Venezuela and Cameroon in Crisis. That's the highlight of our major theme tonight is Venezuela and Cameroon in crisis. When we talk about Missing Pages of History, we like to deal with the realities of the experiences, the issues, the concerns, the well-being of our communities are taken very seriously, and we like to enlighten our people in the world on what's going on in our world, in our realities. So we hope to do that today, because we know that when we look at what's going on, particularly in Africa, and what's going on in the African diaspora, when you talk about the major media, we have no say-so in what they define and what they include in their agenda. So we're going to define our own agenda, and we hope that you join in and help us as we struggle towards the effort of trying to liberate, educate, and motivate our people. So we welcome you to Missing Pages of History, and the agenda for today will follow quotes of the week, learn history through MPH Black Mini Facts. Then we'll have some current events and hot topics. And like always, we'll give you an update and a closing on MPH. That's the order for today. And right now, what I would briefly like to do, first and foremost, just like to welcome one of our members and supporters, Sister Susie. We'd like to welcome you to Missing Pages. Welcome and happy 2019. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone out there in the listening audience. And I'll be with you in a few minutes, giving you Many Black History Facts.
Okay, thank you, Susie. For this audience, we want you to get your pen and a piece of paper, and we want you to write these particular quotes for the week down, which we think we want to give you some kind of tools that can use as analysis to help fight through all this confusion that's going on in today's world. Recently, we ran across two important quotes from our forefathers. We say history should be the basis that we should use that will direct us towards our liberation, and we should listen to our forefathers. And it says that from one of the quotes from Brother Malcolm X, it talks about, or he states that, "I have always felt that the black leader whom white men consider to be responsible is invariably the black leader who never get anything done." That's real interesting. This is one of the legacies, one of the quotes he left for us. And we want you to use it as a gauge, maybe when you begin to listen to the so-called leadership in the African communities. Think about what Brother Malcolm has left for us as we celebrate the so-called month of African history. Another quote of the week we would like to highlight is from Somori Michel, the first president of Mozambique. He once stated, "The day you hear the white speak of me in good terms, that day do not share your secrets with me, because that means I would have betrayed you already." That's a real interesting quote from Brother Malcolm and Brother Michelle. So before we just share this too with you, give you something to think about as you go through your daily struggles of trying to advance humanity and your people. Think about this when you're often listened to and are confronted by your so-called African leadership class. So right now, we're going to move forward, and we're going to always share with you some history that you may or not be aware of. So we can bring in Susie back, and she can talk a little bit about MPH Black Mini Facts for today's program. Susie, what are some little black mini facts that you have chosen today to share with our listening audience?
Okay, the black mini facts I'd like to share is regarding the diversity of history of historically black colleges and universities. While Jewish and African American communities have a tumultuous shared history when it comes to the pursuit of civil rights, there's a chapter that is often overlooked in the 1930s when Jewish academics from Germany and Australia were dismissed from their teaching positions. Many came to the United States looking for jobs due to the Depression. Eczema and rising anti-Semitism, many found it difficult to find work. But more than 50 found positions at HBCUs in the segregated South. Originally established to educate free slaves to read and write, the first historically black college and universities were Cheney University in Pennsylvania, established in 1837. By the time the Jewish professors arrived, the number of HBCUs had grown to 78. At a time when both Jews and African Americans were persecuted, Jewish professors in the black colleges found the environment comfortable and accepting, often creating special programs to provide opportunities to engage blacks and whites in a meaningful conversation, often for the first time. In the years that followed, the interest of Jewish and African American communities increasingly diverged. But this one shared experience of discrimination and interracial cooperation remains a key part of the civil rights movement. And Cheney is in the University of Pennsylvania. Okay, and the next mini black fact I'd like to introduce to everyone is inoculation was introduced to America by a slave. Few details are known about the birth of Wondemus, but it is assumed he was born in Africa in the late 17th century before eventually landing in Boston. One of 1,000 people, African descent, living in the Massachusetts colony. Wondemus was a gift to the Persian church minister Cardinal Mather from his congregation in 1706. Wondemus told Mather about the centuries-old tradition of inoculation practiced in Africa. By extracting the material from an infected person and scratching it onto the skin of an uninfected person, you could deliberately introduce smallpox to the healthy individual, making them immune. Considered extremely dangerous at the time, Mather convinced Dr. Zaville Boyston to experiment with the procedure when a smallpox epidemic hit Boston in 1721 and over 240 people were inoculated. Opposed politically, religiously, and medically in the United States and abroad, public reaction to the experiment put Mather and Boyston lives in danger, despite records indicating that only 2% of patients requesting inoculation died compared to the 15% of people not inoculated who contracted smallpox. One of the most traditional African practice was used to inoculate American soldiers during the Revolutionary War and introduce the concept of inoculation to the United States. And I've just given you two mini facts of our black African history.
Black, thanks, Susan, for your mini black facts for today, and we hope that you have learned something. What we're going to do right now, we're going to pause for the calls, and when we come back, we're going to do some current events and what's going on in our community. In terms of finding out what's going on in our community, we're going to bring in our brother Impel, and we're going to talk particularly about what is happening in Vincent Willow. So stay tuned. Don't you go nowhere. You listen to Missing Pages of History. We're going to pause for this call.
One, two, three, four. walking around with their heads in the sky. City's aflame in the summertime. Control the sound of soul, shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to zoom. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Governor Norton, he had a news conference in which he stated that he has a change of mind, in other words, in how he thinks about things. The thing about it, a lot of times racism is embedded into individuals, probably from the point that he was born. This kind of, doing his behavior, he felt like he was doing nothing wrong because his parents embedded him in it. And as I think about when he was running for governor, the fact that a lot of black organizations invited him to come speak, but most of the black organizations, he always came up with a different reason. In other words, that he couldn't make it. He thanked them for their invitation and everything. So it makes me think that what he did back then in 84, he knew exactly what he was doing. The only thing, he just felt like it wasn't going to come out. And now that it came out, and he's still being arrogant enough to say that he won't resign, which he's getting people from all different kind of organizations, political, social organizations and everything is asking him to go ahead and resign. But I don't think he's going to do that because he actually really feels that it was a joke and he did nothing wrong, and which he did, but it's all embedded, I think. It's embedded in him
to
believe a certain way toward blacks.
It's really interesting how the so-called African and black leadership class is dealing with it. Most of the things that I've seen from those who are in position, so-called political leadership in the African community, they are saying that they have a good relationship with him. He's being very positive toward the community, and maybe that's something we should just forget about because, people learn and change and move on. What did you say of that kind of attitude? It seems like when people have a tendency to display the racist behaviors or tendency toward the African community or the black community, we have a tendency to just write it off and saying, well, they can do better or, they're a changed person. What you make of that philosophy, just in general? You think he should get a pass on this?
Think of it, he shouldn't get a pass, and that's just like I was listening to the gentleman from the Richmond NAACP office. The thing of it is funny the type of, you never know what some of these organizations' agenda is, and I think as far as Governor Northam, I'm pretty sure he'll support him and everything, but that's just because he's supporting him. He's doing it because he has an objective in mind, and it's not that he really deeply cares about the African community. And why, like the NAACP, I don't know why they choose not to really look at the facts and look at everything for what it is, because we've been too forgiving to things that have happened to us over in the past and the future. We continue to do this instead of looking at it for what it is and saying, no, I object this and work against it. But for whatever reason, their objectives are different and they have these kind of views.
All right, Susie, thank you for your perspective on this issue of the Virginia governor, Ralph Northam, and his recent discovery of him displaying racist attitudes towards African people in 1983 as a medical student. We'd like to know what the listening audience think about this. We'll give you a chance later on to call in at 818-337-0016 to give your views and your perspectives on all the very issues that we discuss on today's program. Right now, we can go to more of a critical issue in terms of what's going on as relates to our underserved communities. Right now, Mr. Space History, we'd like to bring in our brother, M-Buck. M-Buck is an intellectual, he's an educator, he's a political organizer. He has a long history of working in Venezuela. We'd like to first bring him in, and we want him to give us his analysis on the current crisis in Venezuela. Brother M-Buck, we first would like to welcome you to Mr. Pages of History. Welcome.
Thanks, Lee. It's good to be here and have the opportunity to interact a little bit with your audience.
Okay, Brother M-Buck, you are a very unique African. I'm saying you're unique in the sense that very few of us get a chance who was born inside the border of the U.S. to be able to travel abroad, and particularly to be able to travel abroad and live in other African nations to get a chance to learn and understand our people. And this is one reason why we wanted you on this program, because you bring a perspective based upon not only an intellectual perspective, but a concrete perspective is for actually being able to live among the people in Venezuela. Can you just briefly tell this audience, just briefly, a little bit about who you are and give us your historical analysis of what you think is going on in Venezuela?
Okay. I'm a black educator and a black power economist. So what I do is concentrated on how things are happening in the world, how they are going to affect black people, what black people can do to take control of the situation, what black people can do to start making history again instead of allowing history to make us. What got me interested in Venezuela was when Hugo Chavez became president. And I began to investigate and discover the black population in Venezuela. It was pretty similar to the black population here as far as the overall population is concerned. So I took a trip to Venezuela to kind of like size the situation up. And as a result, I just decided that I would spend a lot of time there. I ended up buying a house there. And for the last, I guess, 10 or so years, I've been splitting my time between Venezuela and the United States mostly. But the area where I live in Venezuela is a mostly black area. I live in an area called Barlovento. And most of the black people who live in Venezuela live in that area. And there are a lot of different towns and cities in that area. So I live in one of those towns. And it's interesting in that, like I said, the people that I'm dealing with are primarily black, but you can see how there are cultural differences affecting us. We have values in this country that concentrate on certain elements. And there are black people in other countries that have similar values, but they are prioritizing different elements. So it was difficult to really get things established there because the elements that I was looking for, that I was concentrating on, were different from the things that they were looking for and they were concentrating on. But with time, things kind of like evened out, and I began to be able to feel the situation there pretty much the way the people there were feeling it. And I was able to educate a lot of the people there to things that they had not thought about prior because they were stuck within their perspective. The perspective that they had become accustomed to ever since they were little children and babies and things like that. So they were able to enlighten me, and I was able to enlighten them at some point. And particularly when it comes to the black people in Venezuela, I feel I'm capable of just about representing what it is that many of them are feeling. And that's important because the situation in Venezuela now has taken a turn in the last 2 or 3 years. It has taken a turn, and racism has become more and more evident and has taken center stage more than it ever has in the past. And that's partly due to the fact that the blacks there are beginning to recognize themselves in the same way that the blacks in the United States recognize ourselves. And they are beginning to entertain different points of view. What they consider to be normal for all of their lives, they are now seeing that those things aren't normal at all. So it's an experience. It's really a different experience. That's why it's important to not just make visits to an area for a few days or a few weeks. You really can't get a feel for what's going on until you're living among the people in these lands, in these countries that we are seeing in the news, and really not understanding what is going on.
Okay, before we deal with the crux of what's going on in Venezuela, Brother Embuck, can you just give us a little flavor in terms of what were some of the interests among Afro-Venezuelans? What were some of their interests as relates to their interests of African people in the United States? And what were some of the things you shared with them that you thought they needed to know? Let's get a little taste of some of the interests and ideas they may have had of us and some of the things you may have shared with them that they should know about us.
Well, the primary thing is that we're the same people. One of white power's abilities has been to convince black people in different parts of the world that we are different, and we aren't different. We have been impacted in different ways by white power, colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really the same program. So we have to recognize our oneness. That's the first thing. The other thing is language barriers. We need to be able to communicate more, but we can't because we speak different languages. We need to learn different languages, or we need to figure out a way to overcome this obstacle between us communicating with each other. People are writing books in Spanish that people in this country can't read because they don't understand Spanish. There's a lot of material in English that they can't read because they don't understand English. One of the things that I prioritized when I went over there was to give classes in English, try to teach people to understand English. And that's something that they wanted because they want to be able to speak English. They want to be able to understand English. Another thing are differences in priorities, like time, for example, how black people in this country consider time. We are more into that white thing with this English stress on being timely, showing up at the hour, doing things when they should be done. But the black people in Venezuela have a different concept of that. They don't value time the way, well, they don't place the same value on time that we place on time. And that can cause some issues when groups from different parts of the world are intending or attempting to communicate with each other. For instance, there might be a meeting. The meeting might be at 2:00. In this country, we're going to be there spot on, but to them, 2:00 can vary. They might show up at 2:30, 2:45, because their colonialism has taught them to not value time when it comes to people who aren't in positions of authority. So if it's black people that are calling a meeting at a certain time, then they always figure they can show up late because nobody else is going to show up on time. But when it comes to stuff like getting to their jobs, then they can show up on time. So it's not that they don't know the importance of time, it's that they have been taught over time, over the years, that when it comes to certain things, you don't have to value time that much, you know. So those are some of the things that stick out, and they really don't have an awareness of themselves as black people the way black people over here have it. But in some regards, they are more diligent when it comes to their blackness than black people over here. So it's a strange mixture, and part of that failure on their part up to this point to identify themselves as black is one of the reasons they are so vulnerable in this situation in Venezuela now, because bees are popping up now that are going to be very costly for black people because, like I said earlier, racism will begin to play a greater and greater role in Venezuela, particularly if this self-declared president, who is a stool pigeon of the United States, ends up in power. So let me start off with the Venezuela situation, Lee, by commenting on an article that you texted out to people about Venezuela, what activists need to know. I think it was a very good article, and I think they are trying to really get to the heart of that situation, and they do to a degree. But there are some points that I want to make about that article. They were addressing the truth in Venezuela, and their truth number one is that President Nicolas Maduro is the legitimate president, and that is true. But Maduro is losing the confidence of the Venezuelan masses, and we can go into that later. But it's important to recognize that, because this article represents two parties in Venezuela. They represent the party, the Socialist Party, that is presently the legitimate government of Venezuela, and they are representing the opposition party, which is being funded by the United States and is being manipulated in order to carry out a coup d'etat in Venezuela. But there's a third party, and that party is the people. And the people at this point are not in support of this new guy, Guaido, because they know he isn't legitimate. But at the same time, they are not supporting Maduro the way they had been previously, because Maduro and his associates have been doing things that they are not in agreement with. And that's very important in what is going to happen in the future, because the present socialist government doesn't have the support in Venezuela that it used to have. So you have this government with its program. You have the illegitimate government that has this program, but you have the people who know what they want to do but don't have the organizational skills, or haven't up to this point organized themselves enough to really make themselves a force in the government. So if Guaido, the guy who is supposed to have declared himself president, if he and the U.S. rule, then it's going to be really bad news for the people of Venezuela, the poor people. And I should make a distinction. There are the white people in Venezuela who are the ones who are supporting Guaido, and there are the colored people, the brown people and the black people in Venezuela who are the traditional Chavez. So it's important to keep that in mind. When they are talking about the demonstrations in Venezuela now, they are talking about the ones that are being spearheaded by the white people. These are the same element that has been trying to overthrow the government ever since Chavez took power in 1999 or 2000, whatever that year was. So they're still trying to take control of the government. And they couldn't win the elections, so they resorted to following the scheme of the United States. And it's important to note that every day the U.S. is more and more taking front stage in this process. They are relying on the Venezuelans to do it with U.S. input. Every day, the U.S. is taking front stage more and more in this process, and that leads to dire consequences for the people of Venezuela, because the U.S. government is not the least bit interested in the well-being of the people in Venezuela. So Maduro is the legitimate president, but he doesn't have the support he once had. They say truth number two, the economic crisis is caused by outside intervention, internal sabotage, and the decline in oil prices. Now, I don't think the decline in oil prices has anything to do with this economic situation in Venezuela. This is totally a process caused by outside intervention by the United States and the governments in other countries that are going along with the United States, and is caused by internal sabotage. This has nothing to do with the decline in oil prices. The decline in oil prices has affected all of the oil-producing countries, but none of them are experiencing what Venezuela is experiencing. And really, Venezuela should be better off than most of the other countries in the midst of this crisis. So the decline in oil prices, in my opinion, doesn't have anything to do with what is going on in Venezuela. It's totally outside intervention and internal sabotage. That's what's going on in Venezuela right now. They have a third truth. The opposition is violent, not the Maduro government, which is true. It has been violent all along, and it is continuing to be violent. And that's why they are doing things in order to hope that the United States will intervene when the Maduro government responds to the violence. So when you hear about violence, if the established government is violent, it is in response to violence that the opposition started. The Maduro government is not carrying out violence, but it's important to know that many of the people in Venezuela, many of the supporters of Chavez, are failing to make the distinction between the violence of the government towards the opposition in response to the opposition, and what the government will do if the supporters of Chavez want to have a demonstration. They are looking at the response of the government to the violence of the opposition, and they are saying, well, if we demonstrate, the government is going to do the same thing to us, because they don't have the confidence in the government that they used to have. And that could play out to the disadvantage of the people as this process continues to go along.
Let me stop for you, sucker, Brother Imbo. Then I go on my phone lines. There are people waiting to ask questions or comments, and this is a very timely, important subject, and we're glad that you have taken time to share your realities with us as it relates to your experiences in Venezuela. Now, when you say if the pro-Chavez forces go in to demonstrate, you said they don't have the confidence in the government in terms of how they may or may not respond to them? I'm not quite clear. Make that clear to me.
Exactly.
What is their fear?
Because now there are things taking place. The people are losing confidence in the government, and they have reasons for losing confidence. Now, I don't think Maduro is acting against the people in Venezuela. But I think he has done some things that have put the people on alert. So now the people are looking at the National Guard, the police, the military elements in Venezuela as threatening to them, because they don't see the military doing anything in Venezuela to change some situations that could be changed. They see the military as being corrupt. And whenever there seems to be a dispute between a business interest and some people, then it seems that the troops show up to support the business interest instead of the people. because the prices are ridiculous. That's one thing. And for instance, when I was about to leave the last time, the price of transportation is ridiculous. Like when I a trip from where I was to Caracas should be about 150 or 200 bolivars. But instead, the bus drivers are charging 700 and 800 bolivars. So the government has sent people to these terminals to kind of like check the prices. Well, they have sent as military personnel to check the prices. So you see these military people in these bus terminals with all of this, these weapons in their military attire, carrying these weapons, and they are questioning these bus drivers. When people get on the bus, they question the bus driver, well, how much are you charging? And the people are saying they are overcharging. But the bus driver will go talk to this soldier or these two or three soldiers, and then get back in the bus, and, you know, everybody leaves, and everybody has to pay this outrageous price for this trip. The same thing is when there's a dispute about the cost of a product. The government has this program whereby if people see somebody, a merchant, overcharging, they can advise the government, and the government is supposed to have some people there that are going to come and represent them. But they see, when they make complaints, they see the government, be it one of their officials or one of their military people, come in, look at the situation, and don't do anything. They're seeing situations where people who are Chavistas, but are not part of the Socialist Party, when they have gripes or disputes, they see the Socialist Party not representing these people the way they should be doing them. For example, in the latest mayor's elections, the people in one municipality elected a man mayor who was not a part of the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party refused to see him, refused to recognize that he was the mayor of that municipality, and they appointed one of their members as mayor. And that person did run for mayor, but she didn't win. So they ignored the fact that the people in that area had voted for who they wanted as mayor, who was a Chavista. And they gave the victory to the woman who was a member of the Socialist Party, but she came in second to him. The guy that won pretty close to 60% of the vote. It was 50-something percent of the vote. Instead of giving him his seat, they gave the seat to one of their party members. And the people really didn't like that, the ones who knew about it. And another thing is the treatment of the campesinos, the farmers. People don't like the way the government is dealing with the farmers and the communes. And there's a reason for the government's response, in my opinion, to the farmers and the communes, because the communes are supposed to be the ultimate stage of the revolution that Chavez laid out. And it seems to me that as the communes develop, the people in the government are viewing them as competition rather than as progress towards the socialist society that Chavez has created. So what they are doing, for instance, the federal government is supposed to provide the communes with seeds, and you don't know, I don't know whether they are sending the seeds or not. They could be sending the seeds, but the seeds don't get to the campesinos, the farmers. So somewhere along the track, there's somebody acting against the campesinos, or somebody corrupt is intercepting the process, intercepting the seeds, so that the communes don't have the seeds they need to plant, and they see that as critical, because if enough of the communes are planting their own food, that could relieve the food shortage in Venezuela. So there are a lot of differences that are popping up. In general, the people, and I'm talking about the people of color in Venezuela, these people see the resolution to Venezuela's problems as an internal thing. They feel that the government can go internal and eliminate most of these issues that are affecting the Venezuelan people. But the government is concentrating on external assistance, particularly on China. And the people don't know what's going on in these negotiations. They know the government is going into negotiations with China and other countries, but they never see what the details of these contracts are. And they are afraid that the government is mortgaging off the resources of Venezuela in order to maintain power. So there are a lot of issues going on. And another thing is, like, the water over there is terrible. I mean, it is absolutely terrible. I wouldn't even take a shower in it. So I'm asking, well, why hasn't somebody done something about the water? And people really don't know, but to show you how people are thinking, some people tell me that the government doesn't want to solve the water issue because there's a lot of money being made selling bottled water. And they think that a lot of the people in the government are making profits from the sale of bottled water, and therefore they really don't consider resolving the water issue that much of a priority. Now, I really don't believe that, but I'm saying that in order to show you what the people are thinking about what's going on over there. It's not as clear cut as we might want it to be, and because it's not that clear cut, a lot of stuff could come off that maybe otherwise would not come off. The support for the present government over there isn't as solid as it should be. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, Brother Embo, you are sharing a very unique perspective. But I'm going to have to tell you, pause for a second. We're going to take a station break, and when we come back, we're going to open up our phone lines. We have some callers who would like to raise some questions with you, and we're going to allow them to participate in about 2 minutes. You are listening to Missing Pages of History. We're going to pause for this call, and based on what you have heard about what's going on in Venezuela from Brother Embo's perspective, feel free to call in at 818-337-0016. We'll be right back.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people a better day is coming for you and for me. With just a little bit more education and love for our nation would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss
than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say. And how long have you held your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
we'll make a better society. And if you had a
we'd like to welcome you back to Missing Pages of History. We will continue our discussion with Brother Mbok. He is sharing with us his experiences of being in Venezuela, which is very interesting. And what we're going to do right now, we have some participants been waiting for a while. They'd like to make ask a question or make a comment. We're going to bring in caller 6057. We'd like to welcome you to Mr. Page's History. Caller 6057, your question or comment based upon what you have heard on the show today. Call 6057.
Certainly.
Mike is yours.
Thanks. Certainly, Brother Mba, thanks for the information and insight that you've provided regarding the situation in Venezuela. A couple of comments. From what I've read about the election process in Venezuela, the most recent one in which Nicolas Maduro was reelected president. Let's see. Participation in those elections were open to all political parties that were willing to participate. Now, from what I've read, let's see. The people, the parties that did not participate, chose not to. So therefore, the claim that by the U.S. government that the elections were undemocratic is false. From what I understand, voting is not compulsory; it's optional, and it's not mandatory. It's not necessarily mandatory. And also, I wanted to point out the fact that. That the military is not from what I've heard over the news is that some segments of the military, or at least the leadership, is in support of Maduro. But I think that because of the economic hardships, I think is leading to the corruption. And that those forces, in other words, the current bourgeoisie in Venezuela, because they control, they have the money, they're able to buy off certain officials or get officials to look the other way. And this is not necessarily the blame of any one individual in Venezuela. I think it's a consequence of the extreme difficulties that the blockade has caused in Venezuela, and in fact that historically it had been a one resource economy, that is petroleum, and it never developed its resources in other areas.
You made some interesting points. Let's start off, if I can remember. Let's start off with the election. The election process in Venezuela is more democratic than in the United States. There was no, they had international observers for this latest election, and all of them said that it was straight up. There was no underhandedness. As a matter of fact, two of the opposition leaders received almost 3 million votes. The other one received more than a million votes. They pulled out late. And they pulled out late, why? Because the U.S., the same hypocritical government that's saying that the people didn't vote or couldn't participate, the U.S. instructed those opposition leaders to pull out of the vote. That's what the U.S. did. So that's one thing. There's no issue, no legitimate issue with the vote. The Maduro government is the legitimate president, the legitimate government of Venezuela. And in my opinion, they have done very good. They have done very good since the time he was elected president under the circumstances. They have done very good. But you're dealing with a situation where you have a country like the U.S. and, you know, pardon the phrase, but when you start stirring doo-doo, dissent just goes to all different places and starts affecting all different people in some strange ways. And that's what you have here in Venezuela. You have the U.S., this external force, working with internal scoundrels and traitors in order to disable the Venezuelan economy. Venezuela became a socialist government. It became socialist politically, but it never became socialist economically because the capitalists control the economy. In Cuba, when Castro took over, all of the capitalists left the island. So Castro didn't have to deal with that. But in Venezuela, all of the capitalists stayed right there. So they, from day one, have been a thorn in the side of the socialists. And that's one of the reasons the socialists have had so much trouble trying to convert the economy from capitalist to socialist. Another thing you mentioned about the corruption. The corruption is part of Venezuela's history. You can go back 250, 300 years. Corruption has always been an element in Venezuela. And it has been one of the drawbacks in Chavez's program, not because the program championed corruption. It's a drawback because you're dealing with people that grew up in corrupt society. So many of the Chavistas got this corruption inside of them, and if everything isn't ideal, then this corruption is going to be played out by a lot of people. And even if things are ideal, you're going to have some people who are corrupt. That's one of the reasons that it's difficult one of the reasons that makes the doubt of the people in Venezuela understandable, because they expect corruption. And there was one other thing that you mentioned. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I want the audience to understand. The legitimate government in Venezuela is the government that the people elected. And the government, under the circumstances, has done a good job, in my opinion. But the fact of the matter is that all of this stirring the doo-doo by the United States has affected things in ways that are playing out and can end up being disadvantageous to the government. That's the point that I'm trying to get across. All of these factors, there are a lot of factors in play that can result in the overthrow of this government without a military intervention.
Okay. Hello, caller, would you like to quickly respond, caller? Then we'll go to our next caller.
Okay. Thanks for sharing that, brother. And the other point I was raising was regarding Venezuela's dependence on petroleum, and the fact that it never diversified its economy. to be able to withstand,
yeah.
you know, the falling price manipulation
exactly.
and whatnot.
Exactly. That was that played a role when Chavez first came into power. They were trying to diversify, and Chavez wanted to emphasize agriculture, and he told the people from the very beginning, "You all have to start planting. You all have to start planting." But it was a young population, and they didn't want to plant. They didn't want to do that type of work. Some of the older people, more experienced people, began to plan. The government set up a program where a lot of land in Venezuela was owned by white people who didn't have the rights to that land. So Chavez set up a program, and he said, "Okay, you all come in here and show me the paperwork that says you are the legitimate owners of this land." And if people didn't have that, the paperwork that said they were the legitimate owners, Chavez took their land from them, and he gave them to the people. He set up a program where they gave acres and acres of land to anybody that wanted them, and gave them seeds so that they could plant. But the young people didn't want to plant, so that set them up for this economic warfare that has worked so excellently 15 years later. Now, this time when I got to Venezuela, I noticed that there are a lot more people planting. There's a lot more land that is being used to raise crops. But again, it's the older people who are doing this planting. The young people still don't want to plant. The young people are relying on food provided by outsiders. And like you said, or as you suggested, with this oil income, they could purchase food from outside and bring it into Venezuela. That's when things were going well. But when all of those capitalists decided we're going to bring this thing to a head, they cut off access to all of that food. So Venezuela, the government couldn't buy that food anymore and couldn't distribute it to the people the way it had in the past. So what you're saying is correct. But they were trying to fight against that. But they just never they could never make any worthwhile headway.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Caller 6029, caller 6029. Welcome to Missing Page of History. The mic is yours.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Let me ask the brother, you know, I'm glad that he moderated his position somewhat with respect to the influences of the prices of oil, because certainly one of the things that we're very clear on is that 6 or 7% of the Venezuelan economy was dependent upon oil sales. And of course, we understand in terms of the blockade imposed by the U.S., that has made a huge dent in terms of his ability, in terms of financing the basic needs as a government. But the more important question is that, you know, in the question of propaganda in Venezuela, one of the things that Brother alluded to earlier, he talks about the fact that the people's position is that the government of Venezuela doesn't want to have clean water, and that, in fact, it's more profitable to have bottled water. Well, my question is that if you're saying to me that historically Venezuela has always been under attack by the West, specifically the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So if we understand that reality, then in terms of the government's ability to do things, to some extent, it's being compromised. And I don't get a sense in listening to you that the masses of people understand that the government is being compromised. And I'm wondering to what extent the propaganda play a role in terms of facilitating people's views in terms of what's really going on with the government.
That's a good question. The people, my experience in Venezuela is that now the people understand real well what is going on. But you have the people who have power and the people who support the capitalists and their supporters, that they don't care. Okay? They don't care if I just lost my train of thought. What was that? Can you tell me what it was again? Because I lost my
train of thought. I'm just concerned about the question in terms of propaganda. Because one of the things that the people are getting these ideas, and the question is where these ideas coming from. Because the concrete history is very, very clear. And when we talk about the exploitation of the Venezuelan economy, it's very, very clear. But yet, there's a disconnect.
Right.
The people don't seem to get it that this country has been under attack well before Hugo Chavez,
right.
And it continues to be under attack. So these ideas that these people are fomenting, where do they get those ideas from? Is it from reading newspapers? Is it from television? Where do they get these ideas from?
Yeah, a lot of them are a result of them being under so much pressure now. And when people get under that type of pressure, just being able to find enough food to eat, people start listening to things that they wouldn't normally listen to. They start eating things that they wouldn't normally think to. You have a population there where people almost every believer they get is going into food. They don't have money to buy clothes. They don't have money to buy shoes. They don't have money for medical coverage. They don't have money for anything except food, and they are feeling it, and they want to change. And sometimes things get to a point where people want to change. They don't care whether X is guilty or not. They just want to change because they're under so much pressure. And another thing is that historically, the governments in Venezuela have done a real good job of under-informing and under-educating the people, particularly the people of color. So their range of ideas was limited, particularly in regards to what it was they could accomplish. It wasn't until the time of Chavez that most of these people even felt that they could participate in the voting process. So most of what they have learned has been since Chavez took power. So they are getting, and then again, come to think of it, the government can be functioning one way, but when you have people in that government who previously were known to be corrupt, then that comes into play because there were, like I said, corruption. These people grew up with corruption. Before Chavez had power, a lot of the Chavistas were people who were in government earlier and people who were in the military earlier. They had positions of power, and they had a record of acting corruptly. So the fact that these people are now Chavistas doesn't change the fact that these individuals are now Chavistas doesn't change the people's impression of them because the people knew them before they were Chavistas. So they are expecting a lot of these individuals to be corrupt. So there are a lot of elements that come into play, stuff that just seems to pop out of the woodwork. And because the present government is so vulnerable, it could have an impact on their ability to sustain themselves. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I got you. But let me just ask you an unrelated question. And that's the question in terms of U.S. Complicity. When we talk about the criminal activities by the U.S. government in terms of blocking the exports, blocking payments, preventing the government from financing its debt, blocking of foreign exchange. When we talk about these criminal acts by the United States, are the people in Venezuela, particularly the working class folks, are they particularly attuned to this criminal activity of the United States, and do they perceive it as criminal activity?
Generally speaking, they don't know the details, but they see the government as a criminal government, a terrorist government, but they don't see the details, okay? So they don't trust the U.S. government, but then they want to come to the U.S. They don't necessarily want to come here to live here, but they want to see what life is like in the U.S. They see it on TV and and all of that stuff. But they know the U.S. is a criminal government. But, you know, that's as far as it goes. I mean, people everywhere are telling me, in Venezuela, I run into people everywhere that are making negative but true statements about the U.S. But understanding this and understanding their response to it are different phenomena. They know the U.S. is against them. They know the U.S. wants to cause them trouble. But does that mean they are going to support their government against the U.S. under any circumstances? And if they have these perceptions or these ideas that their government is not functioning correctly in place of supporting that government, they might do nothing.
Hello? All right, caller. Yeah. Any other response, caller, because we have to move forward.
Well, no, we can move forward. Go ahead.
All right, thank you, caller. Tell us an audience, you are listening to MPH, Missing Page in History. We are talking with Brother Imba. He, for years, been living in Venezuela. He's given us his perspective on the realities in Venezuela. Brother Imba, we'd like to thank you for your contribution to today's program. You have about 2 to 3 minutes. Just give us your final thoughts that you'd like to share with the rest of the world in terms of this issue and this crisis that's going on in Venezuela.
The thing that I want to say most is that it has become a very complex situation. And it shouldn't be complex, but it has become a very complex situation. And people can repeat untruth, untruth, untruth until people act as if the untruth is the truth. And this is taking place in Venezuela now. There are factors coming into play that nobody could have imagined. And those factors, unfortunately, are working to the advantage of the forces like the U.S. and those people who are being traitors to their country in Venezuela. So this should be an open and shut case, but when you just, like I said, stir up the doo-doo, you generate responses that are unfortunate. It's easier to destroy something than construct something. And the destruction process is what countries like the United States rely on when it comes to eliminating progressive governments like the one in Venezuela.
All the notes, Brother Imbach, we'd like to thank you for sharing your perspective and helping fill in one of the many, many missing pages of history of our people as they through our movements and struggle. And we'd like to stay in touch with you because as time goes on and people like to learn more and more, become more and more interested in terms of what's going on with our brothers and sisters and our communities in Venezuela as relates to our people globally, we'd like to use you as a resourceful person to help us fight through this clarity. So again, we'd like to thank you for your contribution. And listen to the audience, we're going to call for the pause, take a station break. When we come back, we're going to talk about and give you updates on what's going on with MPH, how you can support us, and then we will make that transition towards our next program. So we're going to pause for the call, so we'll be right back. You are listening to Missing Pages of History.
Yes, I would. Good evening again. I'd like to just remind everyone that we have our quarterly raffle drawing fundraiser, which will be held on Saturday, February the 23rd, 2019. It's at 1 o'clock p.m. Need not be present to win. And if you'd like to support us by purchasing a raffle, then you can call us at 804-726-3217, or you can email us by going to missingpagesofhistory1@yahoo.com. Also, we have our ongoing MPH radio program, which is a biweekly program on Saturdays, and our next one will be on the 23rd of February, which is the same date that we had the actual drawing. And we have an ongoing MPH T-shirt and cap drive for the winner. You can order one by going to www.mphinc.org, or either, as I said earlier, you can give us a call. And also, we'd like to remind everyone that we have our MPH TV show with Comcast Channel 95 or Fios Channel 36, and it's on Wednesday nights from 9 to 10 p.m., and it's a weekly show, and we also have live call-ins during that time. Those are just a few of the events that we have coming up in the near future.
And to thank Susan for those announcements, and just to add a particular point in terms of how you can support MPH, we'd like to remind you that we are a community development corporation, nonprofit corporation, 501(c). If you'd like to send any contribution, donation in, you can send it to MPH Inc., P.O. Box 27, 782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Your support is welcome and needed, and we have open membership drive now. Again, you can email us at missingpagesofhistory1@yahoo.com. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation today on this particular program. We'd like to remind you that this is a biweekly program, and our next program will be here on February 16 at 1 p.m. Again, to find more information about MPH, please visit our website, which is www.mphinc.org. Until next time, come and join us. In order to go forward, we can only do this by filling in our missing pages of history. We'll see you on the 16th. Thank you for your support.